We're going to start this afternoon going over the answers to exam number one. Some of these things I am going to write down if I feel like I need to clarify something. Some of these things, though, are directly in the notes. Some of the questions are straight out of the notes, so I'm not going to write every little bit of the answers, but please do let me know if you have any questions. So, and I guess to follow the language in the class, I should call this test number not one, not exam number one. So, first question, there may be some points coming back. So, because the jump to the second part of the question, I asked something about what would be the pressure of ethanol vapor in real life compared to something we do in a calculation. And after discussing it over with the morning section, I'm now less certain of the answer I came up with, which I'll explain the answer, but I am going to try to research and see if I can come up with an outside answer. And if so, well, fortunately, all these things are digital, so it's easy to adjust the scores if I need to. But let me discuss the way that I had graded it, because let me discuss the way I had it in my mind. So the first thing you're told is you had water and ethanol in a rigid, sealed, heated flask. You were told that both of them have high amount of intermolecular forces. And most importantly, you were told that they were in vapor form. So you had a pressure gauge which told the total pressure and a separate sensor which showed water vapor's pressure alone. So if we treat gases as ideal, then the total pressure is just the sum of these individual pressures, which I'll call this water and ETH for ethanol. We were told the total pressure was 1.25. We were told that the high water pressure was just 0.50. And so that means that the pressure of ethanol is just the difference, 0.75 atmospheres. Now, let me explain the next part of the question, because the next part of the question said, assuming they act like real gases, not ideal gases, would the pressure of the ethanol vapor in real life be higher or lower than what you calculated? So many people referred to the real gas law and mentioned how there's a volume and an intermolecular forces effect that occurs. And I agree with that statement. But what the question was asking is not how that interaction occurs, or not that the... It wasn't asking about the real gas law for an individual compound, is what I'm trying to say. It was asking what's going to happen when there's an interaction between these two substances. And again, it's possible that my thinking may be off. That's why I'm going to try to investigate. But what I was thinking is this. When the two substances combine, they may have interactions with each other that are different than what their individual interactions may be. And so what I was guessing is that if you add up the pressures, but that total pressure is affected by the intermolecular forces going on, then wouldn't that mean that the individual pressures would be greater? In other words, it wouldn't necessarily add up. So before you start objecting to the points taken off, let me go back and do that research, and then I can settle that question, and like I said, easily can adjust the grades if I need to. But I will write this much in the notes, again, to give a picture of what I was thinking. Intermolecular forces may cause the total pressure to be lower than expected. But what I'm arguing is that the individual pressures may be higher themselves. And I skipped over one small portion of the question, which is to state the term usually used to describe these individual pressures. These are partial pressures. Now, some of you said vapor pressures. Well, the problem with that is that the problem states you're given everything in vapor form. And there's no indication that any significant amount of condensation is going to occur. So if you have everything that stays in vapor, you don't really have vapor pressure. You have the pressure of a vapor, which is something else. So vapor pressure is not the best term to use here. It really is partial pressure. So let me know if you do have questions, but people were pretty quiet this morning. So I'm just going to go from one question to the next, unless you all stop me. There is a question that came up. Is Lab 3 delayed? Well, yes, because it can't be due Monday at least, because I haven't finished completely talking about the calculations. I do need to get that data posted, but the short version is no. Monday at least, the lab is not due. Another question was asked, is the final just like our quizzes and exams, 24 hours in open note? Most likely will be yes. Okay, now moving on to question two. There I gave what's called the van der Waals gas law, which is an example of a real gas law. And in this equation, we have pressure and volume, temperature, the things we'd normally expect, but there are two other factors, A and B. And so you were asked to explain what corrections this real gas law makes to adjust from the fact that they're not ideal gases. And specifically, it was asking you to identify A and B. So if you are looking at that equation, A and B are, respectively, the effects of intermolecular forces and the effects of the fact that molecules have volume. So if you look at the formula in the bracket where pressure is located, that's where the A factor shows up. So that is an adjustment for the fact that there's a pressure drop due to intermolecular forces. And then for V, that has the factor B, which is, again, related to volume of the molecules themselves. Question three. These definitions are straight out of the text or the book. Explain the difference between the terms diffusion and effusion. Diffusion is, well, it can be stated a couple different ways. It's the movement of one substance through another. More correctly said, it's the movement of a substance from an area of high concentration to low concentration. But in other words, there's movement of one substance through another. That's the emphasis. Or through a medium, at least. Effusion is escape of a substance, a gas, through a small opening. So not necessarily traveling through anything else, just trying to get out of a chamber. Now, you're asked whether water or ethanol will diffuse more quickly, and to explain your reasoning. Now, later on, it asks you to calculate the ratio of how fast those two molecules move, and that ratio itself could be used to justify what's going on. There was some confusion again here, and I think that next year I've got to make more distinction between just talking about vapors in general and then vapor pressure. Because some people, again, in this problem, look to the vapor pressure. And you said, well, because of intermolecular forces, they're going to have different vapor pressures. But vapor pressure, again, relies on there being a liquid around. And there is no indication in the problem that there is a liquid. So it's not intermolecular forces that determines which one of these things is going to move faster. It's mass. So, and if you remember, it's the square root of the ratio of the molar masses that determines their relative speeds. So for problem three, we have the rate that water will travel versus the rate that ethanol will travel. And that is the way the problem was worded, by the way. It said, calculate the ratio of rates of diffusion of water versus ethanol. So some of you had it upside down, and you had the ethanol on top. I think I was not that jerk instructor. I think I did not take points off. But just saying, technically, I did ask for the ratio this way around. So this is the square root of the ratio of the masses, inverted though, because the smaller the mass, the faster the molecule. A very much approximating the molar masses, we get 46 for ethanol, 18 for water, and when you solve this, you get 1.60 as the ratio. Now, question four. This is where the internet started going out this morning. You're asked about water and tetrafluoromethane, which are two different molecules, which, leaving out the lone pairs just for a moment, let me go ahead and write their structures. So you're asked about bonds, and you're asked about molecules. So in the first part of the question, you're asked to explain why the bonds in both water and tetrafluoromethane are polar. That has absolutely nothing to do with the shapes of the molecules. The only thing that determines whether a bond is polar or not is a difference in electronegativity. Now, that can be represented in different ways. So, for example, hydrogen is more electronegative than oxygen, so oxygen will be partially negative. Fluorine's a hell of a lot more electronegative than carbon is, so there'll be a partial negative charge on the fluorine. There's a way to write an arrow to show the dipole, and the point of the arrow points to where the charge is moving towards, where it's drawn towards. And then we write a sort of stylistic plus in the arrow to show which side is more positively charged. So if you said this much, that the molecules have a difference in charge at either end, yes. But what causes that difference in charge? And that is a major point that we discussed in class. So a lot of what you all might think about the grading is, well, I didn't know that we expected that. How did we know we need to answer that way? Blah, 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 blah. And similar types of concerns. The answer in general cases is, I probably said it 50 billion times in the lecture, and if I wrote it down and made a big deal out of it, you know that's because I was thinking about what kind of question I'd be asking later on. So, a bond is polar because of the difference in electronegativity of the atoms in the bond. But then part B asks, now, why do the structures of water and tetrafluoromethane cause one of these to be polar and one of them not to be polar? Well, you weren't asked to put the geometries down, but water is bent and tetrafluoromethane is tetrahedral. More simply, that means that water is asymmetric, while as tetrafluoromethane is symmetric. Why does that matter? Well, water, the bond dipoles will never be opposite each other because there's lone pairs there. I just didn't write them in. So since the bond dipoles can never cancel, that means the molecule is permanently polar. And then the other one that's tetrahedral, it's permanently nonpolar, at least due to its structure. There are these dispersion forces that come up in the next problem here. But we call this nonpolar because the dipoles cancel. So it's entirely because of shape. One is polar, the other is not. Now the next question. Explain why the difference in polarity of the substances causes them to form different phases at room temperature. So there are really two parts to this that you need to mention. One is the difference in their intermolecular forces, but also, therefore, the impact of energy on how the molecules behave. So what do I mean by that? If you have more intermolecular forces, like water does, because it has a permanently polar structure, then that means it takes more energy to overcome those forces to pull the molecules apart, which that's not breaking bonds, that's breaking attractions. But if you have something that's nonpolar, like tetrachloromethane, then you don't have the same strength of interactions to overcome. The intermolecular forces are lower, so it takes less kinetic energy to overcome them. And that's why for tetrachloromethane, that amount of energy it takes is small enough that that's why it's a gas at room temperature. Ah, yes, and someone is anticipating the answer to the next question, which was about molecular iodine. So if you think about the halogens, you have fluoride, chloride, bromide, and iodide as ions that all would have a single negative charge. But iodine's a lot larger than fluorine is, even if it has just that same single negative charge. So the charge on iodine is much more spread out than it is in smaller atoms. So the technical way of saying it is that in a molecule with large atoms, like I2, you have a lot of polarizability. Means has the ability to form dipoles. How? Spontaneously. So they just may show up at different parts of the molecule, and they're constantly dancing around because the molecule is, again, polarizable or big and squishy. So the electron density is able to wiggle around. Now, this happens in all substances, and what I'm describing are dispersion forces. But iodine is large enough at its surface area that that's why its dispersion forces are able to hold it together as a solid. It's how many forces we have due to how many partial positives form on iodine's surface. So that's why it's able to form a solid, even though it has no polar bond. And just, again, to make this more clear, the places that are red are showing relative positive charge. The places that are blue are regular relative negative charge. Okay, moving on to sixth question. This was a question, I hear the grumbling already. This is a question that you were told you had an indestructible container filled with steam at 95 degrees Celsius at normal 1 atmosphere pressure. You notice that even if the container is heated to maintain a temperature of 95 degrees Celsius, over time, liquid water forms in the inside of the container. You're asked to explain why, and you're asked to draw an appropriate diagram for it. All right. The most common problem in this problem is you were on autopilot and you answered the question that I did not ask. So I'd say at least half the class talked about how in water there's always some fraction of molecules that are able to evaporate. Yes, if we start with water. We started with steam. So there was no liquid water to evaporate at first. So there was no fraction of molecules with enough energy to evaporate because the fraction was zero. They were already evaporated. So that's one place where answers to this question got off track. The other place was due to getting confused with equilibrium. Because you might remember at some point I had a discussion where we had these different boxes. And we started out with water that was magically transported into the box. Talked about how after some time there would be some water vapor that would form. And then at some point we would eventually reach an equilibrium where the amount of condensation is equal to the amount of evaporation. And that's a great discussion of equilibrium that doesn't give any reason why it evaporates or condenses. Talks about why equilibrium happens, but that series of diagrams does not explain why condensation occurs. Again, because many of you went the wrong direction. You talked about evaporation. Even if you used these boxes, you tended to do it in the wrong order. If you were going to use the boxes, it should look more like this. where you start out with just the vapor to show that only condensation is going to happen. And that means after some time, you're going to have liquid water around. And so condensation is still occurring, but now so is evaporation. And eventually you reach equilibrium. Which is where the rate of these two processes equals each other. But again, this explains why equilibrium occurs, but doesn't explain why evaporation or condensation occurs. So then what would be the more appropriate graph to draw here? That's right, the graph. And so we would draw... Oh, please don't write the... So I haven't gotten to the real explanation yet. That's the whole point. All that I was saying about equilibrium is about equilibrium, not why condensation occurs. Condensation occurs because of this. Because, yes, at any temperature, there'll be different energy molecules in a mixture. And we've seen this kind of graph multiple times before. Population graph. And you might remember that generally we put a line on there to mean some kind of energy barrier. In this case, it'd be the energy to evaporate. But for this problem, what should have been shaded is the left-hand side of the graph, not the right. Why? Because this represents the fraction of molecules that do not have enough energy to evaporate. So, again, most of you had the right kind of diagram where you had energy distribution, but... Uh-oh. There we go. We had energy distribution, but you were again talking about evaporation, even though the question was asking about condensation. So... The next problem was straight out of the notes, and that was one where you needed to not actually calculate it, but come up with the equations that you could use to calculate the total amount of energy needed to convert ice from negative 12 degrees Celsius into water at 120 degrees Celsius. So most of you, I believe, got the graph correct. Again, that's straight out of the notes. Most of you got the types of equations correct. There was one major error that a few of you did, and let me show you what that error was. Because many of you use this relationship that energy that must be added in order to change temperature is proportional to the specific heat of the substance times the mass of the substance times the change in temperature. But specific heat depends on phase itself. So in other words, when you're heating up the solid, that's one value of S. When you're heating up the liquid, that's a different value of S. So if you just gave one value of S and you take negative 12 and 120 and figure the delta T and just stick it into one equation, you're ignoring the fact that there are different phases. Also, the temperatures. So the whole temperature range from where you start negative 12 to where you stop 120, that delta T is not the same for the solid, the liquid, or the gas. It's only 12 degrees change that happens for ice, 100 degrees change that happens for water, and 20 degrees change that happens for the steam. Now, for the ice, the delta T, the temperature change, cannot be negative. You're adding energy, so that means temperature goes up. Some of you kept the negative 12 in and kept a negative in your answer. So, minor detail, but still important, that temperature change in that case has to be positive because you're adding the energy in. So if you have any specific questions about that problem, let me know. But let's go ahead and move on to the last problem in this exam. Problem 8, which was about phase diagrams. So the only issue there is how some of you wrote your phase diagrams. Because you might have written something like this. But if you look at that diagram, in one area, the slope is a negative slope. In another region of the diagram, the slope is positive. Well, for a particular substance, the slope is either negative or it's positive. So it can't be both. So if you look up the diagram for carbon dioxide, it looks more like this. It's still a curve, but it's a positive slope curve, which means that, like most substances, when carbon dioxide is compressed, put under pressure, it prefers to go to the solid phase instead of remaining in a liquid or gas phase. Now, you were asked to label where solid, liquid, and gas occurs. Pressure is traditionally the y-axis. Temperature is traditionally the x-axis. There are two points here. These are straight out of the notes. The one that's where the solid, liquid, and gas areas all meet, that's called the triple point, which is where not just all three forms exist. I mean, you could be up in the mountains where there's snow on the ground, but you're breathing air that's got water vapor, and you're drinking water. So all three of those phases are around. But it's whether they exist in equilibrium or not that's the key. So the triple point is where all three phases exist in equilibrium. And then the other thing that asked for was a critical point, which is the point that's on the right-hand side where liquid and gas are boundary. So yes, that does happen to be the end of a phase boundary, but it's more than that. It's where the difference you can observe between something being a liquid versus something being a solid, that disappears. You end up with something really high density like a condensed phase like a liquid, but something that has the molecular mobility, the ability to fill up a whole container like a gas. So it's not that the liquid and gas, it's not that they become the same as each other, the same phase. They form this intermediate, this supercritical fluid. And that's why that's called the critical point. So test 2, problem 1. This was an equilibrium problem involving carbon reacting with hydrogen in order to form methane. So you were told that the partial pressure of hydrogen is 1.22 atmospheres. And you're told that the Kp is equal to 0.262. So you're asked to calculate the partial pressure of methane in this reaction. So this question doesn't ask anything about Kc, so we don't need to do a Kp-Kc conversion. But since it deals with pressures, we do need to write an equilibrium expression. So Kp is equal to the pressure of methane divided by the pressure of hydrogen squared. And notice that there is no carbon because it's a solid. So that means we just substitute. We get 0.262 is equal to the pressure of methane divided by 1.22 squared. And solving, I got that the pressure of methane was equal to 0.39 atmospheres. Oh, the average, I haven't gotten it yet because that's the one that kept crashing, so I haven't finished. I'll let everybody know what the average is once I am able to wrap them up. So moving to problem two. Problem two was more complicated. I will admit that. And it's not exactly like a problem we did in class, but it is an ice problem. And let me just write down the information you're given. You're told that you have 0.015 moles of ammonia and 0.015 moles of oxygen gas. And you're told that they're placed into a 1 liter container. And then last you're told is that at equilibrium, the concentration of one of the products, nitrogen gas, is equal to 1.96 times 10 to the negative 3. And it asks you, what is Kc? So most of our ice problems are where we use an equilibrium constant to solve for something. This is the reverse direction, because it tells you one of the concentrations at equilibrium. Now, you need the chemical equation for us to get any further. So it's ammonia gas reacting with oxygen. To form nitrogen gas and water. The important thing here, and let me make that a little nicer. What's important in this reaction is that all the substances are gases, so all of them go into the equilibrium expression. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to come up with what our initial change and end or equilibrium concentrations of all these things are. So the initial concentration, it's easy. Because you're told that you have 0.015 moles in a 1 liter container, which means you have 0.015 molar. And that's the same for both ammonia and for oxygen. This is right at the beginning of the reaction, so there's no nitrogen, no water. Now, the change that's going to occur. This is more complicated because it's not like a lot of the acid-base examples we did. The acid-base examples, everything had 1-to-1-to-1 stoichiometry. But here we don't. And so the best way to represent it is to use X and put the stoichiometric coefficient in front of that X. Because whatever X is, the change that occurs, you're going to have to multiply by the stoichiometric coefficient anyways. Now, one other detail, the reactants, they disappear. So that's going to be a negative change. The products have to appear because you can't have a negative concentration. So those have to increase. So you're going to end up with 0.015 minus 4x, 0.015 minus 3x, 2x, and 6x. But you're told what the equilibrium pressure of nitrogen gas is. And at equilibrium, the pressure is equal to 1.96 times 10 negative 3. That's given in the problem. And so that means you can now solve for X. So going back and solving for those final concentrations, I get the following values. For ammonia, it was 0.01108. For oxygen, it was 0.01206. For nitrogen, it was 0.00196. And for water, it was 0.00588. So, substituting back into the equilibrium expression, it is the concentration of nitrogen squared times the concentration of water to the sixth. That is water vapor, so it is present. It is not water liquid, so it is not 55 molar. Then we have ammonia, and then we have oxygen. So we'll get 0.00196 squared times 0.00588 to the sixth power divided by 0.01108 to the fourth power times 0.02206 to the third power, which comes out to approximately 6.0 times 10 to the negative sixth. Now, due to rounding, your number might have been ever so slightly off from that, but it should have been something close to 6.0 times 10 to the negative sixth. Moving on to... Oh, no, not moving on. I forgot part of the question. Part of the question was asking, why is this Kc not the same thing as Kp? And you didn't have to calculate it, but it did ask. So it's because, it's not because one's concentration, one's pressure. That's obvious from the fact that one's Kp, one's Kc. It's the fact you don't have the same number of moles of reactants and product. Now, yes, it's true that... equilibrium constants... I'm thinking of another problem. So yes, but this is Kp versus Kc. They can be the same as each other, even though one is concentration, one is pressure. And they are the same, again, when you have the same number of moles of reactants and products. In this case, we go from 7 moles to 8, so it's not the same. That's why Kp is not the same thing as Kc. Now, moving on to the third question. This was asking about... Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Sorry, can you explain that one more time?
Because what is it that... I always get them mixed up. Is it Kp is equal to Kc times Rt to the delta T, N?
Oh, man. I guess it's probably as good as mine.
I never do that problem, so I always have to look it up. One second.
I think that's right. And then I think it's inversed for...
going back to Kc. So yeah. The point is, delta N is not zero. So that's why they're not the same. Eight moles product, one mole seven moles reactant. So you have an increase in one mole. So that means you are going to have that RT factor, which means KP is not the same thing as KC.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Sure. Sure. Okay, so we were moving on to bleach, hypochlorous acid, HClO. And you're asked to calculate a pH of that in solution, which means automatically it's a dissociation problem. Now, you're told that the Ka is equal to 2.95 times 10 to the negative 8. And since that's a lot less than 1, that's why it's a weak acid. Now, some of you tried to take the negative log of that, which such a thing exists, that's called the pKa. But that doesn't tell you about acidity. pKa is just another way of expressing acid strength. So you can't use the Ka value to tell pH, not directly like that. But because the Ka itself is small, that means it doesn't dissociate. That means it's a weak acid. So then we can set up our ice table, because you're told that the initial concentration of hypochlorite is 0.20 molar, and we'll assume, as we do in all the other problems, that there's no H plus or hypochlorite to worry about. Then in terms of change, this is one of those simple one-to-one stoichiometry cases. So it's just negative X for the reactants and plus X for the products. The end concentration would technically be 0.20 minus X, X, and X, but we're going to eliminate X from here because X is small. X is going to turn out to be much less than 0.20, which, okay, so I know I still got to do the quantitative way of knowing that, but if you solve for the answer, it is tiny. It's something times 10 to negative 5, and so that means it doesn't have any effect on 0.2. That's why we can ignore it. Some of you forgot you could do that, and you solved the quadratic, which you got the same answer, you just had more pain along the way. So if I can move to this last page here to finish solving, because the Ka expression generally is H plus times A minus over HA. So in this case, it's going to be X times X over 0.2. Remember that we simplified. And that's equal to 2.95 times 10 to negative 8. 2.95 times 10 to negative 8. So that means X squared is equal to 0.2 times 2.95 times 10 to the negative 8, which works out to be 5.9 times 10 to the negative 9. So the square root of X, the only value that matters is the positive one, and that is equal to the H plus concentration, because this is an acid dissociation problem, and that equals to 7.68 times 10 to the negative 5. So negative base 10 log of that, is equal to 4.11. Okay, moving on to the fifth problem. This is something very much in the notes. You were told that you have this reaction that's at equilibrium, and that the reaction involves an overall decrease in potential energy. So in other words, it's releasing energy. And you're asked to draw a reaction progress diagram for this. Some of you are still confusing reaction progress diagrams and reaction coordinate diagrams. So on the left is the diagram that you needed to have. Reaction progress on the x-axis, energy on the y-axis. The one you don't want in this problem is the following. Because this reaction coordinate diagram, where we look at activation energy in the transition state, That's just for one set of molecules reacting. So that's not the appropriate diagram for this case. Because Q and K don't show up in a reaction coordinate diagram because you don't have more than one set of molecules to play with. Now, the question asks, briefly state the Schott-Liesse principle. But there are some fussy problems with wording in a couple of cases, but most people got the right answer, which is that if you have a system at equilibrium that gets disturbed, then it will try to return to that equilibrium. Now, the last problem, I can hear the whining and cursing already. The last problem asks about the Schott-Liesse principle because it says, imagine water is continuously removed. It says, using the three definitions of equilibrium discussed in lecture, explain why the quantity of acetic acid produced will be increased by constantly adding water. Some of you barely said more than what the problem tells you, that yes, because water is being consumed, that's why acetic acid is being produced. Question is, why? And it does ask you to, in this problem, to explain what Q represents, trying to give you a hint that is one way to answer the problem. So if you constantly remove products, Q is less than K, which is why the reaction goes forward. And maybe I didn't put underlines and highlights to emphasize it, but then I had gone over in class how to answer this question based on the three definitions of equilibrium. So that's why this question was straight out of one of the lectures. So the other two definitions of equilibrium, because one definition is you have constant concentrations of reactants and products, and that's where Q and K come from. If you change one of the concentrations, no longer constant. And in this case, Q is less than K. If you constantly remove products, the forward reaction rate is always higher. So it always keeps trying to move forward. And by removing products, you're effectively putting it uphill in terms of energy, so it wants to drop in energy again. Concentration, rate, and energy. Those are the three ways of describing equilibrium. Okay, the next question was about sulfur dioxide and oxygen reacting to make sulfur trioxide. So let me write the reaction equation just so you can see what I'm looking at. So sulfur dioxide gas reacting with oxygen gas to form sulfur trioxide. You're told that the volume of the container suddenly shrinks by half, and you're asked if sulfur trioxide will increase, decrease, or stay the same as a result of the volume changing. So some of you convinced yourself out of the right answer, because you thought, okay, nothing affects an equilibrium constant except temperature. But that's true, but not the point. An equilibrium constant won't change, but a volume change of gases can involve a change in Q. Now, most people, in fact, argued this not mathematically. What you all said is that because the volume went down, the pressure went up. And that, therefore, to respond to that increase of pressure, the reaction wants to move in a way that decreases the pressure, which means it's going to move to the side with fewer moles, which, sorry, I forgot a 2 in my products there. But the product side is still, even with that correction, the lower number of moles, and so it is the product that's going to form. Now, a confusing number of people said sulfur trioxide will decrease, even though in your explanation you also said products will form. Those contradict each other. And I'm not quite sure where that came from, except that some of you, I'm thinking, were in such a hurry, you didn't look carefully enough to see if I was asking about sulfur dioxide, the reactant, or sulfur trioxide, the product. I'm guessing that's what happened. Now, a couple people tried to relate it back to ideal gas law and said, well, if the volume goes down, the moles go down. No. Matter doesn't disappear. Concentration or pressure could change, but moles won't change just because a container changes. So, we change number of moles. So, just like in a KPKC question, if the concentration changes, it's going to affect one side more than the other. And in fact, if you did it the mathematical method, you found out that the new K, not K, Q, the new Q is one half what K should be. So that means you have a Q that's too small, and so it wants to make products, and so concentration, or the moles, of sulfur trioxide increases. And then finally, about a catalyst. That's straight out of the notes, so I won't write it here. There were two diagrams that you needed, and some of you accidentally split one diagram in two. Because in class, I wrote a reaction coordinate diagram for a uncatalyzed reaction and a catalyzed reaction. But I put them in one diagram to show the difference in activation energy. The other diagram I drew then was what I call the graph, which is where a fraction of molecules have enough energy to participate. Again, straight out of the lecture for catalysts. So, one diagram shows that a catalyst changes the activation energy by providing a new reaction pathway with that new activation energy. It doesn't, though, change anything about the identities of the reactants or products, so it doesn't change the heat of reaction, so it doesn't change equilibrium. So that's why catalyst has no effect on making more products.
If we drew two graphs side by side with each other, will we get points knocked off?
It won't be that you get points knocked off if you had the catalyzed and uncatalyzed side by side, but then you'd be missing the graph, the one, the energy distribution graph, which is really what we used in explaining why there'd be a difference.
So when it said
you needed two graphs, part of the question was to determine what are the right two.
Okay, but if you put the two right graphs, but you just separated them into two different graphs.
Fine.
Okay.
Yes. Technically, you gave me three. I didn't even think to mark off for that. Now, speaking of trickery, I was not intentionally trying to pull any tricks on this exam. Your instructor, I guess, was so last minute or something getting this posted that in the hurry, I added the number of points up incorrectly. So if you go back and look at your exams, because a handful of you have them already, the rest of you will get them after I finish with lecture here. I'm just going to keep working. I figured out later on that I really did have the right number of points on the exam, and then we put 10 more points on there, which means it was the wrong number of points. So I just took the 10 points back off, but I'm going to put those 10 points on the next exam, because I really was trying to give everybody a break. I just messed up the math in my head. So I'm not trying to give points and then take them away again, not intentionally. So when you all see your scores and your exam, everybody's going to say, hey, what about the 10 bonus points? They'll be on the next exam. Don't worry. I know. Wow! Instructor can't add. Multivariable calculus. No problem. 2 plus 2?